Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 203 for July 13th, 2009.
I've got Quadrophonics in my van.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID, audible_com. And by GoToMeeting. Picture yourself on a phone call sharing and explaining something visual with GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/twit.
Welcome to This Week in Tech. I am Tom Merritt, sitting in for Leo Laporte, who is vacationing in China. Thank you, Leo, for letting me do this. It's really fun. We've got an all-star panel for today's Revenge of the Screensavers. I mean, This Week in Tech. On my right, Ryan Block, editor of Gadget, spelled GDGT. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you, honorary Leo.
You can insert plug here. That's what Dvorak did last time.
No, I'm cool. I'm good. That's all I needed.
All right, cool. On my left, Veronica Belmont, host of Sword and Laser at swordandlaser.com. Do you do anything else?
Yes. Texilla on Revision 3 with Patrick Norton.
Oh, right.
That. And also Core. Yes.
Up in the belfry, Roger Chang, who was just on the live stream doing East Meets West with me. Hey, Roger.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Roger is senior producer at Revision 3.
He's my boss.
Yes. I sign her checks. Actually, no, I okay her checks.
And saving the best for last, very happy to have Robert Llewellyn. You might know him as Crichton from Red Dwarf, but he's the host of a fantastic podcast called Carpool. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
And where can people find Carpool?
They can find Carpool on iTunes. It's the at the moment, it's the pick of the week in the UK. It's doing very well on iTunes. Or you can find it on LewTube, which is the same as YouTube, only with my name at the beginning, LewTube.com.
Fantastic. We are going to try to talk about some tech news on This Week in Tech.
I'm okay with that idea.
Everybody's good with that?
I don't know. I think technically it's kind of overrated, but I guess.
Personally.
Big news of the week was the Chrome operating system coming out. This is an operating system that is targeted at small laptops, so netbook type situation. And it's not even out yet. It's only been announced.
It's a twinkle in Google's eye.
Yeah, it is. They say they've got some versions running in-house, but they haven't really showed much off. There have been some leaked pictures out there.
Yeah, well, the leaked pictures turned out to be fake. So what are you going to do about that?
Or are they?
But it's going to look a lot
no,
like...
No, they're pretty fake.
It's going to be based off the design of the Chrome browser.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to look...
Mostly. It's going to look very...
Like Chrome. It's just going to be basically you boot into a browser. Right? Yeah, that's kind of the assumption.
The idea for this is that you're living on the web, probably through Google services like Google Docs and Gmail. Is that something that we want, Robert? Is that, you know, is that going to help your life out?
I mean, I can't... Yeah, I'm a bit stuck with, you know, not being that bothered about operating systems, and I know I should be. And I mean, I use a Mac, and I've used a Mac for 20 something years. I really want to see it, and what I know is you'll all be talking about it for years in the United States before I even see it, unless I come over and actually have a look. So I know it's going to be a long time before I get to see something like that. I'm very interested in it because I would love. It's certainly a thing I want is a little foldy little laptop that's small, you know, because I use my iPhone instead of a laptop now, and you know, it would be great to have a laptop that was small and ran on something that wasn't Windows. That would be a huge advantage to me. I would be very interested in seeing it.
There's no shortage of machines out there right now that are non-Windows and that are netbook based. There's a lot of Ubuntu, a lot of Linux based netbooks.
Very lightweight
out there.
Builds, yeah.
Yeah, and so this isn't anything groundbreaking in that regard. I think the unusual thing here is that Google's throwing out the X windowing system, which is what Linux has run on for years and years. It's, I think, by most people kind of considered to be a little bit antiquated at this point. And they're doing their own new windowing system, which, at least in my opinion, that's kind of been the one thing that Linux has needed to kind of make itself really viable for mass mass end user consumption.
Yeah, they're building it around the Linux kernel, but they're building everything else from the ground up, as far as we know.
Yeah, right? So most of your Linux apps that you normally think of, like, I don't know, Pigeon or Firefox, probably will not work. They would have to be rewritten for this because it's a different visual, different windowing system. And that's assuming that Google even opens it up to native apps. They're right now just kind of talking about the web app aspect, which this is really kind of smacking of Apple back in 2007 with the original iPhone, how that was originally, they said no native apps, all of your apps are going to be web apps. And of course, nobody bought that. Right now, I don't think that's going to work for Google here either.
You know, the difference is, though, they didn't have a good offline strategy for your web apps on the iPhone, whereas Google does have Google Gears, and there's Adobe Air. So there is a way to get those apps.
But it's not so much about offline. It's about hardware access. It's about actually being able to take advantage of the fact that this is a computer. I mean, if you're going to buy a computer, if you're going to spend the money and you're going to have audio outputs and you're going to have, you know, 3G, potentially, things like that, it needs to be able to support that. You can't do everything in a browser. You just can't.
Linux for a long time has needed somebody big to come in and popularize it, standardize it, make it easier to use. Everyone has been thinking Ubuntu is that. And now some of the Ubuntu crowd's a little upset. Roger, do you think Google is actually going to make things worse or better?
It kind of depends on what path they take. If they go into a vertically integrated kind of Apple-esque, where we control, you know, the end user experience by either strictly controlling the SDK or not making it open source, you know, it could just be another, you know, another kind of Apple-like product where, you know, it's in the minority, but it's not going to necessarily take over everything, where people, hey, that's kind of cool, but, you know, I'm going to stick with Windows because Windows lets me do A, B, and C so much better. I'm going to stick with some Linux distro because it lets me do A, B, C or roll my own application.
So Google's already said, though, it's going to be open source. They've been really upfront about that.
Well, that has to be, right? Because they're using the kernel, so they have,
they have to open source
a lot of it anyway?
The low level has to be open source by GPL, but everything they build on top of the kernel can be closed source. But they've already said everything that they're doing with this project is going to be open source. They've put out a call to action to the open source community to help them out and help make Chrome OS great. Chrome itself is already open source. I don't think there's anything really that's closed source about Chrome. So, it seems like they want to do this thing. They want to build the operating system, but they don't want to take it the Apple or the Microsoft route, closed sourcing it.
Now, a rumored announcement for tomorrow is Microsoft's Gazelle browser. I think Scoble has been leading the charge on thinking, well, maybe this is why Google announced the Chrome OS, is to upstage Gazelle. But from what do we know about Gazelle, Veronica? I mean, It seems like it's a browser project from everything I've read.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of, there's not too much information out there from what I've read so far, but it seems as though it's going to be something that maybe will be integrated into IE in the future. I don't know if is it going to be a whole separate browser, or is it going to be something that, a technology that they build into IE later on?
It's interesting because it's confusing for people that they have a kernel. They talk about building on a kernel within the browser Gazelle. The way, you know, how Chrome actually has a process for every tab, they are extending that to processes for every element.
Right, so like downloading images, perhaps, or...
Yeah, or running ads.
Yeah.
Any kind of frame or iframe type.
And also, that would make it more secure.
Get assembled. Also. Yeah, I don't mean... It's a good concept, I think. It's something that Microsoft certainly is going to benefit by doing, but, I mean...
IE could use the help.
Yeah, but I mean, they're also, you know, the word right now is that it's going to be based still on Windows, and I think we all kind of know that at this point Windows needs a pretty bold reboot, and that it's not going to come from the browser. So I'm not sure that this is really kind of the answer to it. I think this is an answer to a next generation browser. But I don't know if this is, you know, how Microsoft is going to fend off Google OS.
Yeah. Have you seen the ads for the new IE, for IE8? The ones with Dean Cain as the host?
No, I haven't seen those yet.
They're pretty
creepy.
Funny, but they actually had one that was pulled because it was so disgustingly
awful. I saw the vomit
awful.
One. Robert, did you see that one?
I haven't seen this, no. I've heard a lot about it, but I haven't seen it.
Well...
No.
To give you a brief rundown, it starts with a guy leaving his laptop on the kitchen table and his wife asking if she can use it. And then she goes and clicks in the browser, and he must have something horrible, like Two Girls, One Cup style up there.
That's what everyone thinks.
Right, so she starts projectile vomiting.
Don't go search for that, everyone.
No, don't. Sorry. Well, that's not a swear word. So she starts projectile vomiting on him, like, repeatedly, over and over and over. And that's just kind of the commercial. That's all that happens. It's like, keep this from happening. Use secure browsing.
Roger's just smirking away over there.
He's into it.
I haven't seen it. I'm seeing it now. It's very funny.
I thought it was pretty clever. Oh. I like it that they're at least trying something new, innovative with their advertising.
Well, it's certainly attention getting, but then they went and they pulled it down.
Yeah, too much complaints.
Once it goes viral, they yank it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but that's an even better way to get attention.
Actually,
I know.
No, that's a good strategy.
I mean, right? that's probably actually how they really got
to
stay viral, was by yanking it.
That
might have actually been
in
the entire plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was probably on the plan, like step five, after it's out, you know, yank it a day later.
And come on, Dean Cain, so awesome.
Really?
Oh, I love him.
Come on.
Still I love so? Him. Scott Whatever. Johnson loves him, too.
That's fine.
See?
Roger,
I'm not alone in this.
Dean Cain?
He's a good-looking guy. Back me up
is
here,
is that the
someone?
Guy who presented it at
no,
the end, who
Colleen,
came in
no.
and came in the camera?
It was a guy from Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Oh, yes, I've seen him. Yes, all right. Yes, he's gorgeous. I love him. I love him.
All right, I'm the only one ambivalent. Ryan's the only one who doesn't like him.
I don't know. I don't not like him. I just, you know.
You're ambivalent.
I mean, you know. I feel threatened.
Sorry, I've derailed us slightly.
Yeah, we need,
get us back
do we have Dvorak on a soundboard or something? Let's talk about some tech news. An interesting posting on Tech Blog at blogs.cron.com says that you'll be able to upgrade your Windows 7 release candidate. That you won't actually, as long as it's activated, you won't actually have to reinstall Vista or XP. You can go straight from the release candidate to your legally purchased version of Windows 7.
Which is fantastic, except for the fact that, isn't this kind of the expectation already? You'd be able to, install the upgrade on top of that?
You couldn't do it with the beta, and there were a lot of people saying, they're not going to allow it from the release candidate. If you've downloaded the release candidate, you're going to have to show your Vista or XP license by putting it in. And what this is saying is you don't even have to do that. You can just upgrade right off the release candidate.
That's
good.
So you
can buy the upgrade version.
Isn't it typically better to do a clean install anyway? Or
would
it not really matter because you probably...
It does make you do a clean install.
It does, okay.
Yeah.
So then what's the difference? I mean,
it just means
at the end of the day,
you could
at the end of the day, it's just an activation.
And
activation takes 20 seconds anyway.
You could conceivably not have Vista or XP and be able to upgrade off the free release candidate.
Yep. I mean, this is kind of getting to the point of, you know, like it's so pedantic, you know, to worry about some of these details with Windows. I mean, I think that the larger problem here is the way that Windows upgrading and in installation works in general. And you know, I mean, one of the things I really like about Snow Leopard is that when it does get released this year and when you install it, it's not only going to just go ahead and install over what you've got now, Leopard or Tiger, what have you. It's actually going to take some of that other junk off there and free up some space during the installation process.
I did that a couple days ago with the developer's version, and I think I gained back like 6 gigabytes.
Ooh.
I mean, that's like a crazy concept coming from the Windows world.
Exactly, because we're used to with all operating systems, when you upgrade, it takes away space.
Mm-hmm.
That's not controversial.
Yes, we agree with you. Yes.
My question is, it's then conceivable for someone to upgrade from the release candidate without necessarily having owned either Vista or XP?
Correct. If you need to reinstall the finished version of Windows 7 later, you're going to have XP or Vista. But as long as you never reinstall it, you can actually take your release candidate, and from what this guy is saying, and upgrade it directly. So it's a money saver for people.
Hmm.
And that's a good thing.
I wonder if that's just pushing people to get the release candidate.
As Patrick would have said right now, I like that thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
He will be joining us later to say that,
would
hope. Yeah, we are hoping to get
soundboard.
Patrick Norton on the show. His car may have fallen on him, or he may have a baby emergency. We don't want him to have to...
Oh, wait. I just saw him pop up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, see? It's like Beetlejuice. You say his name three times.
You heard me talking about him.
He shows up. Well, he would appreciate this... using electrical outlets and cheap lasers to steal data story. We'll see if we can entice him in with this. Did you guys take a look at this?
Yeah, Veronica and I were joking about this on the web. You know, this actually reminds me of that that theoretical hack. I don't know. I don't remember the name of it, but it was that hack where if you stand or if you get near enough with like a truck size Gaussian scanner, that you could theoretically
read the monitor, right?
Pick up a monitor signal from outside of a building, which I've always thought was like a really hilarious
Absolutely.
Concept.
And I remember when we did that story on the screensavers, there was a story along with it. And I can't remember if it was the same people about just this thing. This story is saying you can plug into an electrical outlet and be able to read the electrical feedback from a keyboard and tell what the different keystrokes are and find out what people are typing.
And then there's this laser thing where the lasers can pick up vibrations and then blah, blah, blah. But here's what it basically assumes at the end of the day. Because the electrical one is, I think, like 15 meters is as far as you're going to get a clean signal or a clean enough signal to use it. And then you've got the lasers where it's got to be line of sight and it, you know, it can't be obviously too powerful. And you have to get the reflector set up in the room so you can start collecting this. I mean, basically, it assumes you have access to the machine. If you have access to the machine, all bets are off anyway.
Yeah, there's probably so many other ways to get into the computer in the first place if you're in the general area. Like, why couldn't you just...
hotel room, right? So, like, you're in the next hotel room and you plug into the outlet, you're close enough to be able to
read those
keyboards.
So then you're probably on the hotel's network anyway.
But you don't have physical access to the machine. What if they're off the network and typing their secret emails?
I guess.
Yeah, they're. I guess if they're offline. You're in a hotel and there's a person who's next door to you off the network, and what are you going to do with any of that data anyway? If
this wouldn't work with a laptop anyway either. So if someone's in a hotel, they're probably the laser one will work with a laptop, but the keyboard one is not.
It assumes that you need some level of connectivity to actually do something with this anyway, right? I mean, if they're just typing into a box and they're not connected to anything, I don't know. It's just like. It's fine. I mean, it's really clever, but it's not so impractical. And at that point, it's like a lot easier, I think, for most people to just either break in or wait till they have physical access or wait till that person connects to the Wi-Fi network and sniff their packets.
I just like the idea of lasers.
Oh, of
laser
course.
Beams.
Exactly.
You have a podcast.
This is sort of
that has that in
I know
the
I do
swords.
Like lasers, yeah.
You're the sword side.
I'm typically on the sword end of things.
Yeah. This story is fun for that reason, for the laser and the weirdness aspect. But Robert, does this scare you at all? Like, are you at all worried about this?
Not in the slightest bit worried. Anyway, whatever. I mean, for a start, my office is in a very remote rural location. If someone can shine a laser beam through my window, they're welcome to read whatever they can. I mean, it just seems dark because all the intrusion that you may get on your computer is coming through the little wire that's plugged in the back, not, you know, as in the internet, as in people hacking into it, as in all that, you know, recording keystroke. You know, there's so much software that does exactly this already. That's much more worrying than somebody coming in my room and I'm not here and putting a laser beam that's pointing
that's
at
true.
Something.
There's so many other ways to be worried already. Exactly.
Exactly. There's plenty of other ways to be absolutely freaked out with paranoia. But I don't really need this one.
Yeah, it's just an extra. We can throw it on the stack, but it doesn't change much.
Mm-hmm.
No, and this actually reminds me, and it is probably a good segue into that other story that we have from this week, which is about insecure Wi-Fi networks that are cropping up all over at airports. I mean, that to me seems like a much more likely scenario for get
absolutely.
Passwords, you know, sniffed, mm-hmm. your packets. Sniffed.
I mean, how many times have you been in an airport and seen those peer-to-peer networks come
free
up?
Free airport wireless.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I don't think so.
Has anyone ever connected to one of those here? No?
No, because no.
Yes.
I tried
yes.
to travel.
Yes, I have.
Really?
And it worked?
No, but a long time ago, yes, it did. I got a signal and I got emails and then I switched it off, you know, but it certainly worked. This is probably
and promptly changed your passwords, I hope.
Promptly changed my passwords. It was in LAX. It was in your neck of the woods. Yeah. I wasn't even looking for a signal. Suddenly I got a signal. Get me email. And then I went, oh, where did that come from?
Like, wait a second. Not good.
They used to be really easier to identify. At least in Windows, you could see that it was a laptop card. But now, a lot of times, they look like they're actual access points. So I don't know what these guys are doing.
Well, you can see that it's a peer-to-peer network on the drop-down on Macs. It's pretty apparent.
Well, I've seen some that don't appear as peer-to-peer networks.
Really?
Where they show up as if it's a router.
I've never seen that personally, but I can see why that would be feasible.
I saw that in your neck of the woods at LHR, actually.
Oh, LHR, because I keep forgetting what that's
about. That was his setup, actually. That was his.
Heathrow. Yeah, that was me. I was there with my laser beam and my laptop and my special...
I thought I kept seeing a little red
He's
thing
got a nice little setup over there, yeah.
No, actually, no. I think I did use the one at LAX, but I only did it so I was just surfing news stories, wasn't it? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What?
I only logged into my email.
Yeah, I'm going to set up a Wi-Fi honeypot here at the Twitter office.
Know,
so all of you guys,
see how many people we can sucker into using it.
Exactly.
All right,
that'd make a great story.
We actually have Leo here to do his commercials. it's a smaller version of him, but take it away, Leo.
Hello, guys. Hope you're having a good time doing Twit without me. I'm in China right now, but I had to just stop by and say, go to meeting. I'm using it more and more. In fact, we just asked for a few accounts for some of our hosts who are using it actually during the show to show screens, which is very cool. Everybody's moving to GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting from Citrix. They're the company that does GoToMyPC as well. They really know the inner ins and outs of Windows and how to do remote access in Windows. I don't think there's anybody better, frankly, at remote access than the Citrix folks. GoToMeeting, basically, here's the problem. You know, you're on a conference call. You're talking to somebody and you're showing them something visual. You're talking about something visual, a PowerPoint or a keynote presentation or a drawing or a slide. And you're describing it, and it's just frustrating as heck. What you can do if you've got GoToMeeting installed is say, hey, well let me show you. This is kind of wild. And you go to you say, go to GoToMeeting.com. It takes you about a click of the mouse to get it started. And then you tell them, go to GoToMeeting.com. Here's the meeting ID. And it's kind of cool because they go, wow. And they're looking at your computer on their screen, no matter where they are. They see the presentation. It's great for sales, great for product demos, for training, for collaboration, too. You can both work on a document together. Very affordable. And right now, free for 30 days when you use this special URL. GoToMeeting.com/twit. These guys, I have known these guys going back to Ed Iacobucci, who founded Citrix many moons ago. And I've always thought the world of them and their technology. It's secure. It's affordable. It's effective. GoToMeeting.com/twit. I invite you to give it a try. We now return you to This Week in Tech, already in progress.
Thank you, Leo Laporte. And you can safely assume that Dvorak was out basting his meat during that commercial, and will the next time.
Whoa.
Let's...
excuse me,
what?
It's a twit joke.
Oh.
He's always basting his meat. I've heard him baste his meat. Yeah, he goes off and bastes.
Thanks for backing me up on that, Robert. let's talk about the success of Blu-ray. Has it finally arrived? Gizmodo reporting that Walmart is selling the Blu-ray player only at its brick-and-mortar stores, the Magnavox NB530MGX, for $98. We finally have a Blu-ray player with 1080p support below $100. Everybody's been saying that, myself included, that once we get Blu-ray for under $100, then that's when people will start to flock to it. So is the flocking about to commence?
I'm kind of worried that maybe the price is dropping so low because no one's buying them, and that's why.
Well, it's part of it, and it's also Magnavox, so it's not
exactly
it's not exactly a high-end brand.
Top
of the line, necessarily.
Yeah, and then it's Walmart, known for its loss leaders, you know, trying to get people into the store, so that's part of it as well. I don't know.
And
I mean,
also,
we'll
kind of getting to be that time. You know, the technology's been out for a few years now, so eventually it has to drop.
It does seem like it took a little long to get down $100. Mm-hmm. Are you a Blu-ray fan at all, Robert?
No, it's really interesting. I've talked about this a lot because I work in the television industry in this country, and so all the people I know who are successful have huge high-definition televisions, you know, just the size of a pool table stuck on their walls. And then only one person I know whose house I've been to has a Blu-ray player, and we watched a movie on it, and I went, yeah, that's really good. But it isn't really good. I mean, yes, it was very clear and it was very crisp and the sound was fantastic and they had a very expensive setup, but it isn't like, you know, the difference between a VHS, I mean, I've heard this before, it's not new, but the difference between a VHS tape and a DVD was phenomenal. It was game-changing. It was extraordinary. The difference between a DVD, which I've just been watching with my daughter, we've got a little home cinema here next door, watching a movie on a DVD, sort of medium quality, you know, medium definition. It wasn't that good, but it was perfectly good enough. The sound is very important. We've got a really good sound system. The jump from a DVD to a Blu-ray is just, it doesn't make me excited. What makes me excited is the chance to download films in high definition that I can then play through a projector. That is much better because then I don't have to get a piece of plastic.
Well, I think what you just mentioned is exactly the reason why Blu-ray needs to come down in price so much. Because
yes,
I think for most people, it's not as big of a jump as they would feel necessary to, you know, be like a
it's
kind
not
of
an
requisite
all caps
purchase.
Jump when you say really good. It's just
you know, it's not the kind of thing that people need to go rush out to the store to buy. It's certainly not the kind of thing that I ever really felt the need to go out and get. I mean, I wound up having a Blu-ray player because I had a PS3, but it's not like I would have bought a standalone if the PS3 hadn't existed. And I think the case that is the case for most people, especially those who don't already own a PS3. So having it at a sub-$100 level is definitely going to make it a lot more viable. But I mean, look, you can get a Roku Netflix box, or if you have an Xbox 360, you can stream Netflix. And Netflix is available on a lot of other devices. And there's a lot of other streaming solutions. You have a TiVo. You can do Amazon Unbox on TiVo. There's just so many ways to get content into your home now that don't require a piece of plastic shaped like a circle that you put into a drive.
I think the key, though, it really, if Blu-ray is going to take off, is the cost per movie needs to come down. I mean, if you can get a DVD movie, say, of a first-run movie for like $8, and then the Blu-ray equivalent's like $25, people are going to, you know, opt for the $8. They're not going to... For what you pay, you can get three, you know, normal movies instead of just getting one Blu-ray movie. And as you know, it's already been said, it's the quality is there, but it's not, you know, so different that people are going to spend the extra money. I think it's one of those things where when it becomes a commodity priced item where you can get movies for like $8-$10 and your players are around like $100, I think that's where you start to see movement. But, you know, for right now, it still seems kind of one of those things where it's like, yeah, that's kind of cool if I ever get one, but you know, it's not
yeah, it's not just the price of the hardware, it's the price of the individual movies, and those aren't necessarily coming down. Do you think that it would be smart for them to come out with an exclusive Blu-ray to kind of force people that direction now that the players are getting more affordable?
I mean,
studios can't afford to.
I think part of the issue was that Blu-ray was still a growing or changing spec when it first came out. So unlike HDVD, where you had all this functionality straight out of the gate, it took Blu-ray until like what's it at now, 2.0, to do a lot of the things that HDVD could do, where you had picture-in-picture, you could have a lot of the extras superimposed on top of the movie while both were still running, and that was, I thought that was pretty compelling, but you know, it wasn't something that all the Blu-ray publishers did out of the gate because they knew the players out there didn't support it. So they aimed for the lowest common denominator. So basically what you had were really nice looking movies that were really no different than your standard DVD.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, Sony has attempted to respond, I think, to the demand for online video by building in a decent movie download store into the PS3. But then Microsoft just went up to them, and then at E3 they announced that they were going to do 1080p downloads, which nobody's ever done that before. Nobody's ever done 1080p in any way, shape, or form over the internet on any kind of large scale. So, I mean, clearly at this point, Microsoft is doing a really good job at chipping away at the viability of Blu-ray. I mean, it's hard to see Blu-ray as being that necessary if you can get a large amount of content on an Xbox, you know, downloadable in 1080p, which is, you know, the same as you're going to get on Blu-ray.
Yeah, we've talked about this time and time again. Go ahead.
Patrick Norton, is that your voice coming in?
Oh, hey.
In theory, I was trying to talk before, but nothing was happening, so.
Patrick is joining us, host of Techzilla and the new HD Nation show on Revision 3, which makes it appropriate for you to pitch, to jump in on this one.
I have one thing. I don't think anybody other than Microsoft can afford to distribute 1080p video online right now. And I think saying that to the Roku and the Netflix solutions, I mean, they're certainly near HD quality, but they're not quite there, especially if you're watching on a 1080p screen. I think HD for the most part is still on the early adopter side of things. I think this Christmas is going to be interesting to watch, but the whole Magnavox thing, it's you know, Ryan nailed it. It's a loss leader. It's a bogus brand. It's not a viable player. Most of them are going to be dead inside of 2 years. And, you know, the $100 players aren't going to be around probably till next spring. Yeah, maybe.
And you look at the market. I mean, what it really comes down to, I think most people would prefer the convenience over that bump in quality. Most people would rather have a super convenient way to get something that is DVD quality, not really anything that's worse, but that is at least DVD quality, then they would really care about going out of their way and paying an extra amount of money on top of that to get something that's, you know, 1080p.
Most people don't buy DVDs, though. Most people rent DVDs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, for all of these downloading and streaming and, you know, various like Netflix-like solutions that are just way more convenient, I mean, that seems to be like where things are going.
Yeah,
so.
But don't you think you just upload still, to a
I think there's still a population of people out there that don't have access to, you know, high quality broadband connections and who probably don't play video games. I mean, there's still half the population that isn't online all the time and doesn't even know what Roku is, doesn't even know that there's Netflix on the Xbox and still want to go to Blockbuster
and get a
DVD.
But those, $85 DVDs that came out in like 99, or those were horrible. But the perception of being able to get one for cheaper drove people into the marketplace more, even if they didn't buy that one.
Yeah, and I mean, the kind of people that you're describing, while they certainly do exist, they're not the kind of people who have a $20,000 HD rig that is really going to do justice to a nicely mastered Blu-ray.
So you don't know what a $20,000 HD rig, a $2,000 television right now is phenomenal. The 240Hz televisions coming out from Sony and Samsung, like, you can get them under $2,000, delivered from Amazon, no shipping, $250 Blu-ray player, and they look amazing. If you have the right content, if the content's not included. And also, I have a question for Bob. What were you watching the DVD on when you say that you don't need Blu-ray and you can't see the quality difference?
No, I can't. No, yes, I knew that I would get called out on that. I could see the quality difference. There's no question of that. But for me, the experience of the jump in technological manipulation, the change from a VHS, which is what I grew up with, you know, VHSs were really cool, and, yep, and you could watch a film at home on a VHS tape. You know, that was a major breakthrough. And then when everybody got them. You know, when they first came out, because I'm very old, I can remember when VHSs first came out, and it was very exciting.
I remember when there were VHSs.
but then the jump from that to a disc that you put in, that you could jump forward, you could jump to any point, you didn't have to rewind tape. It was basically the disadvantage of tape. You know, and that jump was phenomenal, was extraordinary, and really made it different, made it, the whole experience different. And when they got cheaper, that's what I'm saying, is that if there was something that was like a bit of gel that you threw at a screen and it became the picture, that's game changing.
No, I'm totally with you. I mean, it's an improvement in quality. It's not a shift in paradigm. And, right. And the shift from VHS to DVD, that was a change. That was a paradigm shift.
Should they have made Blu-ray smaller?
Like physically smaller?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, with that, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. I mean, that was one of the things with DVD. It's like, oh, it takes up less room on my shelf.
I don't think it's the size of the disc that matters. The alternative is no disc at all.
The size.
Yeah.
I think Ryan and Bob both hit it. It's that, I mean, if I don't remember if any of you used audio cassettes, but I remember back in when, you know, we all had Walkmans. You know, to rewind it to save battery, you'd stick it on a pencil and you'd kind of run it backwards on your pencil to rewind it. Being able to jump from track to track on a CD in any order that you wanted without actually having to wait for something to, you know, to rewind 10 minutes, 9 minutes or whatever to get to where you were was amazing. And that's what DVD did for video. I mean, hey, now I can pause it and the picture doesn't look like it's shaking or jittering in the middle. I can move backwards, I can move forwards, and I don't hear my tape, you know, get chewed up in my VCR. It's amazing.
It doesn't wear out.
The thing with Blu-ray is that it doesn't bring anything currently that I find compelling enough to migrate to, even though I did buy a Blu-ray player this weekend. But that's just because of work.
How much did you pay?
I paid $240 at Costco.
Are you totally mad now? Oh, there's a $100 version?
No, because I actually like the one I got.
Okay.
But, I mean, just all the feature sets that they on it don't really seem compelling. It's like, oh, cool, I can download clips from the web. How amazing is that versus being able to see...
So nobody here other than me really enjoys the quality improvement.
I pay extra
on Netflix for Blu-ray. I watch... Mm-hmm. If I can get it on Blu-ray, I will watch it. But that's if I can. Right? I'm not going to pay a lot of extra money to buy something on Blu-ray.
But you don't buy DVDs anyway.
That's the problem.
I've seen your house, dude. You own like 2 DVDs and like 400 games.
Yeah, no, but I'm talking about when I rent. You know, I will pay that premium to Netflix to get the Blu-ray.
Does anybody remember Quadrophonic?
Yes.
Quadrophonic Records.
My friend had it in his van.
Is Blu-ray the... That is exactly right. That is where Quadrophonic would be found in its heyday in the 70s. It was supposed to be the next best thing above stereo, right? Is we'd have 4 channels of sound. And they actually mastered whole albums specifically for Quadrophonic, sold them on high-quality LPs. It was similar to Blu-ray in that you didn't have to... You had the same form factor, although it was different because you could play them on a regular LP player, although you didn't get the Quadrophonics unless you bought the new one. Is Blu-ray going to be like that, where it's like it only appeals to the people who are really into video, the way Quadrophonic only really appealed to the people who are really into audio?
I'd be more worried if it was the new SACD, where it's taken like 15 years for SACD to come up to speed, and it's fine to the point where even the audiophile community, that's really freaking me out when you guys do that. SACD is phenomenal audio quality, but the adoption curve has been minor at best.
I think
Blu-ray is already more successful than SACD, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
I think the thing, though, with Pat, though, is that it's not that I don't enjoy the quality improvements. It's only with certain movies that I actually care to see the improvement. If it's like a Will Ferrell comedy, I could care less if it was on, you know, UHF like 12 a.m. in the morning, because, you know, I'm not going to be nitpicky about the image quality. But if it's something like, you know, Spartacus or some really grand movie that
Spartacus.
I need to see. Well, you know.
that sentence is just so full of good stuff. Roger, you watch UHF at 2:30 in the morning?
And
how do you
Spartacus.
Even do that? Yes. They scrap those bands.
Well, okay, I used to, right? but, I mean, the thing is, there's certain movies that I'm willing to fork out the extra money to see that. Like, for example, Watchmen. When Watchmen comes out with the special edition Blu-ray, I'm going to buy that because I want to see it that way. I bought, you know, The Dark Knight the same way. I didn't opt for the DVD because it was a movie that I was interested in enough and to get the high-quality version. But if it's something that it's, you know, again, if it's like a throwaway movie that I'm just going to kill like an hour or two on a plane, I could care less what format it's on.
Well, if it's a throwaway movie you're going to watch on the plane, you're going to steal it online anyway, Roger. Yeah. You're not going to pay any money for it, and you're not going to care what format it's in.
well, that's, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you know, with that said, you know, when I run by like an aisle that has $3 DVDs, you know what? It's $3.
Sure.
I bought like $5 $3 movies. If I didn't like it, big deal, $3. I can't say the same thing for a $25 Blu-ray movie.
No, but you couldn't say the same thing about a $15 DVD 5 years ago either, or a $25 DVD.
And I didn't buy a lot of those either. I bought
You rented at the same rate everything else cost, and then if you really liked it, you bought the DVD.
Yeah, and that's
everybody's so hyped about Blu-rays cost more than DVDs, and it's an HD cable or HD satellite service costs more than standard def.
Yes, Roger, someone made a comment that Roger's cheap. It is, it's true.
Roger is cheap. We got to rein it in.
The thing is, now
I have so many more options to watch stuff. I can watch it on Hulu. I can watch it, you know, somewhere else. I can watch it on my Xbox. I'm no longer limited to just VHS, TV, cable TV, and my DVD player. I have so many more other sources. So,
Robert, you made the point earlier that you like to download and stream things. Is that right?
I mean, I would do. Yes, I do that. And I mean, and I also do it legally. But I mean, so I get quite a few. I actually rent movies off iTunes because that
me
seems
too.
To make the most sense to me, because then I don't want to keep it. You know, if I do want to keep it, if it's the most brilliant film ever, then I would buy the DVD. Not, I don't have a Blu-ray player. I have no way of playing it.
I'm like the perfect customer. I just spent like $20 this weekend buying a movie that I watched once and then deleted.
Yes.
Like that's, I know,
yes,
I'm crazy,
why,
right?
Why but did I was you buy it? Why didn't you rent it?
Because it wasn't available for renting yet.
You have Netflix.
No, but I want to watch it on the plane now. You don't understand. I had like a 10-hour plane ride. I had to fill that puppy up. So I rented Confessions of a Shopaholic.
I shake my head at you.
I bought it. Still have it. I'll make you watch it.
What? Okay, so we have a few things going on here. One is we don't need to own things as much anymore.
Right.
Maybe it's a like collector's edition or something you're really a fan of. There's also what you just said, Veronica, which is the immediacy of it matters. I can't rent a Blu-ray DVD or even a regular DVD immediately. I at least, you know, at the fastest, I can run down the street and get it, but I can press a button on my computer and get it right away, sometimes streaming instantly before mm-hmm. it's even finished downloading. It's just a matter of access, and we haven't caught the model of access up to what people want yet.
What is that? Since we seem to have multiple models of access, Tom, I mean, basically you're saying, you know, Roger wants it on any format available. Veronica wants instant availability. Ryan's got enough patience to wait for Netflix to throw it up in his box. None of us go to video stores anymore if we can avoid it. Do any of us actually own more than 100, you know, DVDs other than me? Most people... That would make sense.
I waited for everything to drop in price before I bought it.
Does everyone talking right now? Oh, I know everybody. Bob's the only one I don't know. Bob, do you own an HD TV?
No, I don't. No, okay. No. I've got a very very run of the mill flat panel TV. I don't watch that much TV.
We have a
I've
flat
got a 20,
panel.
I've got a 24-inch iMac, which is what I watch a lot of movies on, and we've got a projector, so we watch some stuff on that. So we did watch DVDs on the projector.
HD. No?
What, sorry?
Your projector is probably HD.
The projector is HD. The DVD player going into it, which cost, I think, £19 from Amazon. It was cheaper
like
than the DVD I bought.
$180 US?
No, that's about $19 at the current rate. No, it's about it would be about $25, very, very cheap. And it was cheaper than the DVD I bought, so I thought, oh, well, I may as well have that too. So it's not not a flashy DVD player. It's really bad, but it works. You know, it's never failed. It just you put a DVD in and it plays it. So it's very. I'm working on very low tech. This is really. It was really for the kids, for my children to watch films on. So,
you're just not that interested in having to upgrade. It sounds like.
Yeah, I don't think I can't imagine that I would ever buy a Blu-ray player. I mean, the Xbox route is the most likely. I think we'll probably do. You know, I've got a 15-year-old son, but then you know he is a classic example of the next generation that he doesn't even bother to illegally download films because his friends give him little thumb drives, little USB thumb drives with them on.
Sneak
and that's
in
how
piracy.
They swap them around.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, I mean, someone in the local area is illegally downloading movies, but I don't know. We don't know who it is. But, I mean, I have seen pre-release Hollywood films at DVD quality on my son's computer from a thumb drive. And I mean,
I'm not sure you want to admit those kinds of things on the air.
Oh, I know. Well, it's not me. It's him. He can get arrested.
Throw it under the
arrest my son.
It's just my son. Take him.
Nice.
You represent the new norm, though. According to NPD Group, they forecast that flat panel display sales are only going to rise 1% annually from 2008 until 2016. This is over an eight-year period. They think it's only going to rise 1%.
Is that flat panel TVs or is that flat panels, the glass itself?
Flat panel displays in general. And so in that, they lump together phones and notebooks, at least according to some of this report. But the thing that I think that these reports tend to get a lot of attention for is, you know, oh, like, what does this mean for the industry? And, oh, you know, the industry is failing. No, it just means growth is slowing because saturation has gotten so great at this point.
Have we reached saturation?
And money's not free.
It doesn't mean that people are not buying TVs. Yeah. It just means that the rate at which the industry is growing. I mean, look, you can have a humongous, you know, a $20 billion a year industry. If it's only growing 1% a year, it's still a $20 billion a year industry.
Well, yeah, there's nothing too new about any of the technology that's forcing people to have to upgrade. So if they have a flat panel that's, you know, obviously HD and working perfectly, they don't really need to buy a new TV. So until the next step in major technological upgrades happens, I don't think we're going to see much growth.
So HD, unlike what we talked about earlier with DVD, people threw out perfectly good working VHS to go to DVD. They're not doing that with their television. They're waiting until the television breaks down or gets old or just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, but
television's changed so much in the last 20 years. I mean, I can remember when having one television was a norm in a house when I was in grade school, and then people started adding bigger televisions, and then all of a sudden cable came out, and suddenly there was a television in three or four rooms in the house. You know,
right, but I mean, within the past 5 years, there haven't been too many significant changes.
Yeah, but again, this is growth.
Except
this is not negative growth. This
so
doesn't
much.
Mean that people aren't buying these things. It just means that it's people who are either not buying second units or people who have not bought yet are starting to buy now. Or then there's also, of course, the turnover rate of people who have bought in the past and are buying a new one and getting rid of their old one. So, I mean, again, this is not a bad thing. This is actually, if anything else, this is a good thing. It means that the industry is doing
not
really
declining.
Well,
despite the fact that the home sales have collapsed, durable good purchases have collapsed, the availability of credit has collapsed, people are paranoid about loading up their credit cards.
Durable goods.
durable goods.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although herbal goods probably are doing pretty well in this market.
Yeah.
LCD TVs, which make up the largest chunk of the flat panel market, are expected to see almost no revenue growth over the next 8 years. Doesn't that make business people panic, though? They want to see growth.
Yeah, but this is an analyst report,
because everything we're talking about is sensible. But
Tom, this is like clicking on a dig headline. These guys are basically trying to get people to pay a lot of money for their reports. They don't do that by going, everything's the same as last year. They
he's
do that
saying
by
you're picking a bad story. That's what he said.
It's not a bad story.
That's what he's insinuating. Yeah.
But it's I think a lot of the economic analysis that comes out of, you know, that are like, I mean, you read these things and it's like I've read ones where it was obvious the person writing the analysis never owned or worked with any of the products, or you look at it and they're it's a classic case of the headline being better than the report, you know, or they ignore things like major changes in the market. I mean, you know, it'll be fun to, you know, it'll be fun to see what this report looks like, you know, 5 years from now, if any of us can even remember it.
Let's move on, shall we?
The chat room apparently really wants
you
to move on.
Yeah, the chat room's done with this, which I'm assuming everyone else is. So actually, we probably want to take another break because we have another sponsor that Leo needs to take care of so he can continue to have his show after we've ruined it. So bear with us a little bit, and we'll be back in just a few.
Meanwhile, back at the Twit Cottage, Leo Laporte sneaks in and takes over Twit. I know I'm in China right now. I'm going to be back soon, but I had to mention audible.com/twit2. You know how much I love Audible. It's not just Jason. Oh, no. I love Audible, too. Let me tell you something. I've been an Audible member longer than he has, since 2001. 323 books, something like that. No, it must be more than that now. So let me look at my library. I'm curious to see how many books I've purchased on audible.com. I have the Platinum account, which gives me 2 books a month. Actually, I've had it for so long. I have the old name. It's called Light Listener. No, I'm a heavy listener. Twice. Let me see how many books. Let's see. Program types past all time books. Total number of all time books that I have listened to. I download new books all the time. In fact, I just bought some extras because I wanted books on China. But Audible is such a wonderful resource. Whether you're at work, at the gym, commuting, flying in the plane, you know, and I just use Audible, like, you know, to prevent boredom. Audible.com/twit2 for the Platinum account, 2 books a month, and the first 2 books are free. First 2 credits are free. So a lot of wonderful choices on Audible, an amazing array of books. Go right now and browse. By the way, the new Audible Enhanced Audio file format, amazing. Full quality, CD quality, it's as good as it gets. But they have smaller file formats for depending on the player. Plays on hundreds of different devices. Most of the MP3 players, your Zune, your iPod, your iPhone, your Kindle. Audible.com/twit2. If you go there right now, sign up for the Platinum account. Your first 2 books are free. You're going to love Audible. I've been a member. Now, it says since 1997, and they celebrated their 10th anniversary last year, but I don't think that they really were on the map until around 2000, 2001. That's when I joined. I was a long-time audiobook listener, and when I found Audible, I just flipped my lid. Yeah, 400 books now I've listened to. 400! That's pretty good. Start right now. Start your collection. You'll get to 400 in no time. Audible.com/twit2.
That's the Leo bot that Colleen's been working very hard on. I have to say, it's very convincing.
The likeness is uncanny. Yeah.
Now, Patrick, MPD Group came out with a story saying the world is round. I think this is probably overhyped. No, I'm just kidding.
Usually you're better at mocking me, Tom.
I stole that one from the chat room. UK's National Portrait Gallery is threatening to sue Wikipedia. Now, this is interesting because there are 3,000 images of paintings, all from the 19th century or earlier, and firmly in the public domain.
Oh, okay. That's the big caveat here.
The photos are a product of painstaking exercise on the part of the photographer, says the National Portrait Gallery of London. So their suit isn't against the images. It's against those particular images. It's not. In other words, it's not against the paintings. It's against the photos.
So the publicly paid for photos that were made available on a public website shouldn't be made available
that
to
are
the
in
public.
The public domain.
Even though the National Portrait Gallery has been mandated to make its paintings more available to the public.
They called downloading them an unlawful circumvention of technical measures. Although, as Patrick sort of hinted at, the taxpayer-funded mission of the MPG is to promote the appreciation and understanding of portraiture.
That's baloney.
I'm looking at Robert over here.
I know. I
wish I could talk about it with enormous, you know, artistic merit. The wonderful National Portrait Gallery, which is extraordinary. There's no doubt about it. It does. It is really confusing. I think the whole. I mean, it brings up the whole question of ownership. On what and who owns what and how you own it and what is, you know, because that whole thing has been thrown out. I mean, it used to be very obvious. You go into an art gallery and you took a picture of a painting, they tell you off. That was wrong. You're not allowed to do it. But now you don't need to go into a
you don't need to do that. You can just...
Yeah, but that was for the Flash, usually, not for the actual copyright at the port. I mean, in a lot of cases... Yes,
well, it may have started that way, yeah, but I think it's become...
Use, even if, I'll tell you, if you went in the National Portrait Gallery with a camera with no flash, even today, they'd get a bit sniffy. Those in the uniforms wouldn't like it.
Pretty much any gallery will do that to you. I was in the Picasso Museum in Barcelona with the iPhone out, and they're like, nope. You cannot take a picture.
Oh, I got yelled at so many times trying to walk around the Louvre and take pictures. They didn't like that.
Yeah.
They don't like that.
But I mean, then who does, you know, that is, it's certainly affected, you know, that, the thing I was mentioning earlier on with my son. I mean, those things have affected directly my income. With so many people illegally, or whatever you like to call it, download Red Dwarf, for instance, whereas 5 years ago they used to buy the DVDs. Well, that is, you know, I've felt that personally. You know, we've all seen the very large drop in sales, you know, which is, you know, I think is fair enough. It's part of the way the world's changing. But it is, you know, how can they possibly say that? It's ridiculous. It's the if we can see the pictures anywhere, then okay, they're on Wikipedia as well. It's crazy.
Well, that's what's really unusual about this is that it's not even a fair use argument. Fair use being it's copyrighted, but this is an exception to that copyright that is defensible. These are public domain paintings. So we get into this culture where the copyright... It's become such a bugaboo, and we're so afraid of losing the rights that you're talking about with, you know, Red Dwarf and losing the money that I feel like there's a lot of overcompensation that's happening, and this is a definite example of that.
Well, it's maybe they're worried about losing traffic at, you know, the nationalportraitgallery.com.uk, and they need the banner ads to pay for things or something.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
because they're very the legal threats very like these images are taken on behalf of our client. The client holds the copyright on the images, even though they're public domain images. You took them; they're watermarked. You took them from our database, and it's kind of sad though when you get right down to it. The whole point of public, you know, isn't the whole point of this museum to spread the work? I'm wondering, like, what the internal argument was about this.
It's, you know, it smacks of lawyers to me, which is, you know, someone saying, well, if we let them do this, then that could set a precedent for this. And to cover everything, we should, you know, make a complaint and get these things taken down so we have total control. Now, I'm interested with something Robert said about how you felt the effect of piracy on Red Dwarf. Do you think, though, that people are exaggerating how much damage has been done? Because a lot of times the industry comes out with these billions and billions of dollars. Or do you think that that's dead on?
I mean, I think it has had an effect. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I know the people who, for instance, particularly with Red Dwarf, I know the people very well who distribute that DVD, a big company in the UK, and their overall sales across the board are down 20%. Now, that isn't, in some ways, as much as I would have expected. I would have thought it was more. One of the interesting things that we've found out recently, and it'll take time before we know for sure, but for instance, we did this new series of Red Dwarf this year, which was shown on the UK TV. Now, I was getting Twitter messages within 20 minutes of it being broadcast in the UK from the US, people who'd seen it in the US and were making comments on it because someone had, you know, copied it, put it onto a BitTorrent, and someone in America had seen it. I mean, it was breathtaking how quickly it happened. And there was something like 2.5 million BitTorrent that was being tracked. But what's interesting is that from what I've heard, it hasn't affected DVD sales, i.e. people who downloaded it and watched it went, oh, that's really good, I want to see it, and I've now bought the DVD. So it's a really difficult thing. The producer of Red Dwarf was thrilled when he heard about how many BitTorrents there were because he thought it was a very good sign. You know, so it's very
enlightened.
Well, he is very enlightened. The people from the TV company were less thrilled. Strangely.
I think we are moving towards a situation where you have to accept, and I've said this a million times, so anybody who's listened to anything I've done on Buzz Out Loud or anything will roll their eyes, but we have to accept that the internet is infinitely copyable, that digital content is infinitely copyable, and we have to adjust our business models to that. And it's going to be painful while we do that, but that's a great example of how you can turn it to your advantage, which is, even though you didn't do it on purpose necessarily, having Red Dwarf out there was a publicity stunt, if you will. Absolutely. which helped out,
and which cost the producers nothing. They didn't, you know, you imagine to get your product to 2.5 million eyeballs would be incredibly expensive, you know, in the old media format. And that, and it didn't cost them anything. They didn't have to do anything. They just had to broadcast it, and a few people recorded it, and off it went.
All right. Yeah. The Apple iPhone MMS has been delayed here in the United States. Are you an iPhone user, Robert?
I am. Yes, I am. And it, I think it works here already.
Yeah, I was going to say, we all hate you now because you have it. We have to wait until September. Also, yeah. According to AppMoto.com, it's going to be $55 for the tethering.
I don't know about that.
You know, yeah.
You think I mean, you basically have to take their word on it right now.
Yeah, this is not an official announcement. So
no, 55. No, I don't know about you guys, but I've never really heard about Moto before the story. So, I mean, if you look at how that price kind of plays to the rest of the market, I mean, you know, it's in the $40 range, tethering on other networks. Wouldn't surprise me if AT&T went that high. It also doesn't surprise me that AT&T is not going to be doing the MMS on the iPhone for a little while. But, I mean, again, you know, even if that was the case, it's almost not news, right? You almost expect to be abused by AT&T.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, it's almost news that it's not $65.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
What do I'm unfamiliar with pricing on other tethering plans. Is that around typical or is that
higher?
Yeah,
I mean, if you just get 3G service, flat 3G service, it's usually between $55 and $65. So the tethering, they kind of knock off a little bit on that to kind of, you know, make it a little value for users of the service already. Especially because you're already paying for data, technically, which yeah. is why I think a lot of people just use the tethering anyway, you know, unauthorized.
Yeah, the AppMoto is claiming it's going to be $55 on top of your $35 data plan, which
right.
is, I mean, $55. I mean, that's what I'm paying per month for my Sprint modem, and it's like,
You only pay $55 for your Sprint modem?
Yeah, but I've had it for a couple.
Oh, so you're grandfathered in. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had it for a couple of years. Plus, I'm also frustrated because Sprint finally gave up the 5 gigabyte cap that they basically were unlimited up until last November. Then they finally stepped in line with Verizon.
Oh, come on, Patrick.
And
like, you've ever hit that 5 gig cap?
Download, you don't know Patrick very well, obviously.
Download. Hey, Mister, I download all my movies online. Download 3 movies. You've blown through a 5 gigabyte cap.
You download your movies over EVDO. You really I've downloaded me to believe
I have downloaded movies over EVDO. I didn't say I do it all the time, but I've also, you know, driven 900 miles in 36 hours so I could attend a race on the other side of Nevada. You know, I don't cocoon
you
as well.
You have to download
movies
for that trip. That's
you
a
have
long
to be
trip.
Reasonable, Patrick. I mean, this is not typical. Right.
I didn't sign with Sprint because I wanted to be reasonable. I signed with Sprint because at the time they had the best speed and they had no data cap. And now they've removed one of my two motivations. I mean, I'm not surprised AT&T's pushing MMS because their network's a mess. I've got a couple of friends of mine who are like, dude, I haven't been able to call you in like a month. And it's like, yeah, the phone, my phone's basically stopped working in my neighborhood while they're messing around with the neighborhood. My wife's got connectivity problems. AT&T is sucking even worse than it did last year.
I feel like AT&T's network, at least here in the Bay Area, which is all I can speak to, has gotten worse over the past month.
Oh, it gets progressively worse.
The more iPhones get out there, the worse it gets.
Yeah, they're desperate.
Really, it's beyond pathetic.
Is there a reason why they aren't doing anything to up the bandwidth or to make
they
it
are.
Better?
Well, who says they're not doing
anything?
Because
they hate me personally. Is that it?
Yeah.
No, they're moving to 850 megahertz both in New York and San Francisco and elsewhere. They've purchased bandwidth. They've purchased bandwidth at a better frequency, but it's just going to take them, you know, I think they're desperately trying to get it rolled out before Christmas.
Is it like the Bay Bridge where they refuse to fix the potholes on the East Bay side because they're building the new bridge, so they're just letting the old network go to crap while they build the new one?
Based on the conversations I've had with people like Sasha Sagan from PC Mag and some people I've met over the years in the industry, as they say, is that their networks are just absolutely hammered in San Francisco and
that we are a significant part of sometimes, you know, whining about it to the rest of the country. You think that maybe they'd help it out a little bit.
The bottom line for the Bay Area is actually that they just don't have enough spectrum here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They just simply do not have enough wireless spectrum in this area. I'm sure that, you know, they're
doing
their best.
There was a good PC World article that tested it out in a lot of places, and AT&T wasn't really great.
No,
yeah,
AT&T does
places.
Not have a great reputation. But I'm saying specifically, we're talking about the Bay Area. Specifically, this area, they have a great dearth of Spectrum, and they need to take care of that.
Let's stop talking about the Bay Area and the iPhone and talk about the Palm Pre, actually, which, according to Engadget, Cleanser from the Pre-Central Forum has managed to unlock the CDMA radio so you can use the Palm Pre to get voice and SMS on Verizon.
And they're working on data.
Wait.
Data's still a no-go right now, but they are working on it, yeah. Does that change the game for anybody? If you could, I know Robert's going to have to just, you know, fall asleep on this because no CDMA where you are. But does that change anyone's mind, do you think, out there?
Well, Verizon already announced that they're doing the Pre next year.
Well, they did, and then AT&T said they weren't, and then they said, oh, well, maybe we said too much, but they didn't deny it, and it's kind of unclear.
No. The Pre is coming, or a Palm device is coming, likely the Pre, to Verizon early-ish next year. So I don't know.
So
I
mean, don't worry about it. Just wait.
But I mean, the other thing is you're not going to be able to get a Pre at a reasonable price. Just unlock it to use it on Verizon, and it, you know, it's hacked. So, you know, maybe it's going to get that firmware. I mean, this is kind of like back in the day, you know, buying an iPhone at full price to unlock it to use it on T-Mobile.
T-Mobile's awesome. I love T-Mobile.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's not the kind of thing I think that a lot of people would do.
True.
You know, and especially knowing. And unlike the iPhone at the time, it, you know, the Pre is coming to Verizon, and nobody's disputing that. It's just a matter of when.
All right. So, Roger, any disagreement there?
It's a CDMA phone. Don't care.
Yeah, that's it. I think we're all where Robert already is by geography, which is get off a CDMA.
if it were a GSM phone, I'd show a lot more interest, but it's not, so...
CDMA does work great in rural Nevada.
All the places where I don't spend a lot of my time.
No, but I've downloaded audio over it in the past when I was my short stint as a Verizon customer.
Gotcha. A few other stories to get to here. I'd like to mention the Mario Marathon that's been going on. It'll probably be done by the time a lot of people listen to this show, but ustream.tv/channel/Mario-Marathon. These folks have been at it all weekend long playing Mario to raise money for Kids Toys for Hospitals.
Yeah, for Child's Play.
Cool.
Which is a great charity. I've actually done some fundraising for them as well
in the past. I tuned in right before we left to drive up here. Those guys look so cracked out.
Do they?
I mean, they look. I can't imagine. They were like in a rough shape.
Oh man!
How long did
they play for? The full weekend, or?
Yeah, I'm trying to check and see if I'm trying to load it right now and see if they're still going.
When I got in there, it was at like 50 hours or something like
they
that.
They were at 60 some hours. Yeah,
and they were all like incoherent. It was great. It was actually really entertaining.
I can imagine
they're going to be seeing some Mario jumping around behind their eyelids for a few days after this. You know how when you play video games for a long time,
the music is still going through them. So where are they at right now, money-wise, at least?
Is that accurate? 18,034?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Wow, that is some dedication. So anyway, shout out to them.
Yeah, good on you.
Good on you for just being able to be awake.
I know.
And do that.
I could have done it this weekend after being so jet-lagged. Probably could have pulled that off. Yeah. I stayed up until like 4 reading that book last night.
Maybe the next time you go on a long-distance trip, that should be your way of recovering, is to do a marathon.
Yeah.
For charity.
Maybe do that.
And also, finally, the Memristors story. This is on NewScientist.com. Who had a chance to read this?
I did not get
all
this
the
far.
Way through to the end and understand every last bit
it.
Of it. No, lots of shaking.
I'm
your
sorry.
Head. Memristors are it's the missing piece of what? Resistors, capacitors, and transistors.
You're asking me? What do I look like? I have a degree in electrical engineering or something?
You kind of do.
is it my Unix hippie beard?
The beard is getting to electrical engineering status there. Memristors, if you want to know the effect, if you're like, you know what, I don't care about all this, what are they going to do for me? Well, first of all, they'll make faster RAM possible. Mm-hmm. They'll make faster hard drives possible, a la flash memory. But also, they think they work the way our neurons work. So it could be a way to make artificial brains.
Ooh, we were just watching Caprica this weekend.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to give anything away.
But they use memristors to make the silence.
Sure. Maybe. But you should watch
it. Look, if it's going to enable the pending robot apocalypse, I am both excited and terrified.
Right. Agreed. Or what if what if it could actually be able to accept a brain image from you into a new brain?
Yeah, I don't really buy that. I mean, I not the concept. The concept seems, I guess, crazy but feasible. But I don't really buy that that's actually a valid transfer of consciousness. You know, just because it's a copy of you doesn't mean that it's you.
So it's a philosophical question for you, Ryan.
Yeah, but I think we're also kind of getting off the topic here. I mean, this is some crazy technology, Roger.
It could be.
Ryan.
You know what? So is a hyperdrive, but don't have one of those anytime soon.
I want a replicator.
Yeah, but this is real, Roger. We haven't discovered hyperdrive. This is something where we actually...
Oh, we've discovered hyperdrive, Tom. That's what Area 51 is for.
Now we're into no agenda territory. I love it. Robert, you've played robots. Do you have any extra insight into this?
Yes, I've been playing robots for years. I'm very excited by it. I mean, I didn't see it on the list. If it was on my list, I missed it. The story, so I want to read it now. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. I wrote a play 25 years ago about which is how I ended up in Red Dwarf, which is about a machine, a thinking machine, and that whole concept of
robot.
I mean, there's a lot of all those theories about the number of computers on the internet, replicating the number of neurons in the brain, fascinating. And if there is some other new step, I mean, I'm equally terrified and fascinated by it. So it is a real. I'm conflicted about the whole area, because I think it is. I think something along those lines is inevitably going to happen if we don't run out of water and air.
Oh yeah, no kidding. We do have to survive to get so far to use this as a survival mechanism.
Oh, but don't worry. If we don't run out of water and air, and we do make this happen, I'm sure that the robots will cut off our water and air.
No, terraforming. Yes, they will. They will.
Terraforming Mars.
Yeah, or the moon.
Or the moon.
Most likely Mars. Moon.
Well, we just give the robots the moon. They can have it.
No, I would
we don't
like...
need it.
No.
Then they'll get mad and come back and wipe us out for exiling them to the moon. You don't want to anger them, Ryan.
It's true.
To end on a high note,
Now, I think the most fascinating part of this article for me, and it is a pretty thick article, is the fact that memristors, they think, may actually work the way neurons work, meaning that instead of having to have an analog of, this many... computers, this many processes working would emulate, that they could actually build the memristor's system to work the way the neurons work.
So we'll have Alzheimer's and questionable memory and weird sociological...
Robots with Alzheimer's. Great.
That could be our salvation right there.
Hey,
another classic of sci-fi.
That makes me think of the 23andMe stuff, which I did, I'm really excited about. It's another topic I've been talking about all weekend.
Do you think that's irresponsible?
What?
To have a web company tell you what your genetic profile is?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Wait,
it is
a web company? They're not a genetics company?
They're a genetics company.
They happen to be on the web.
Right, okay.
Right. But you have to answer a lot of questions and you feel a little bit like, ooh, do I really want this information out there in the world? Just floating around. And your name is tied to it, so it's out there. But I'm more curious about my ancestry more than the genetic issues. I guess, because they look for a lot of genetic disorders. But I also think it's important that we can study all this data and kind of learn more from it and, put it out there on the web and have people contribute to the study of
the
genetics.
You fill out a survey, swab your cheek,
send it in to them,
and they do a genetic profile.
Essentially, mm-hmm. What, Roger?
I thought they took a blood sample.
No, you. There's a test tube that you have to spit into for like 5 minutes.
For 5 minutes?
You have to get a lot of spit,
Wow.
It's really gross.
All right, well, we've descended into all of us dying and spitting into test tubes. So let's... any final thoughts before we wrap it up here with a very fine and long-standing show that we've been able to wreck in Leo's absence?
We're sorry, Leo. We tried. We really, really tried.
No, I think it's been fantastic. I really enjoyed talking to y'all. And thanks to Leo for giving me the opportunity to sit in. And thanks to Colleen and Dane for doing such a great job cooperating and making it happen. Robert, thank you for staying up late and chatting with us crazy people about all this stuff.
It's been great. I mean, I've been 90% of the time completely out of my depth, but the 10% I was with you, I really enjoyed.
Well, you couldn't tell by looking. It was fantastic to hear your insights and talk with you. And if people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
Well, I think I would love them to go to watch Carpool, which is my weekly podcast where I talk to interesting people, including, interestingly, coming up soon, Leo Laporte. I drove him around Petaluma. We saw the wonderful sights of Petaluma. It's a great show.
Well, that's the cool thing about Carpool. You actually get people to jump in the car with you. There's a show called Drive Time. Have you ever heard of it out of Connecticut or out of Boston?
I've been looking around for other similar shows. Yeah.
But I've watched a couple episodes, and I'm sorry to hear about your Prius, by the way.
Yes, it did get rather bent. It's in sort of two pieces, but luckily I'm in one piece. I was very lucky. Yeah, no, I was. I think the official term is called T-boning. I was driven into the side. A guy drove into the side of my car at 50 miles an hour. He didn't see the very large stop sign. So it wasn't my fault. So, you know, I don't have a lot of guilt. And I was knocked out when it happened, so I don't remember anything about it. So strangely, even though I was knocked out and taken to hospital in an ambulance, I feel very lucky.
Well, we're just glad that you're okay.
Yeah, we're absolutely glad. Yeah. Glad you made it through and can keep making more carpools. There's a few more with the Prius in them, correct? That were pre-taped.
There's a few pre-taped ones, and I was actually in the new model Prius with Leo when I came up to the Twit Cottage in May. So yeah, it was great fun. We had a great day there, and I know for a fact that all the people who work there are lovely.
That's absolutely true.
That's a fantastic image. Fantastic image of a mashed Prius. Mine is worse, much worse than that. It was seriously smashed to bits.
And once again, what's that URL where people can go for Carpool?
It's Lutube, LLEWTUBE.com. And it's on iTunes.
The ghostly voice of Patrick Norton, thanks for getting in with us. We're so glad to have you on.
Yeah, my apologies for running late. I tried to do something new and exciting on an old XP system. Actually, it's XP on a new mini, and the netbook was just evil. Oh, now it's finally logged in. That's really insane. No, I just tried relaunching into Skype one more time, and after 8.5 minutes this time, it actually was able to log in. Skype hates me. Thanks for letting me come out, guys. It was fun.
No, it was good, and you hopped in right at the right time. It was great having you on, as usual, my friend. Roger Chang? It's good to have you on, too.
It is. Sounds enthusiastic.
I didn't give Patrick a chance to plug, but you're plugging the same thing. Roger produces Techzilla, which Patrick co-hosts with Veronica. And where can folks find that?
You can find it at revision3.com/Techzilla or Techzilla.com.
Or iTunes.
Patrick, do you have anything else you want to plug, too?
Techzilla with a K. Actually, HDNation.tv, HD Nation starts with Robert Heron and I on Tuesday of this week, which is all high-def content, including quite a bit of Blu-ray, which apparently no one watches or will watch. But we also talk about things like over-the-air and online delivery of high-def video.
Fantastic. Ryan Block of Gadget, GDGT.com. Pleasure as always.
Thank you. And, you know, actually, I forgot to plug at the top of the show that Veronica has done a little bit for us as well. She did our intro video.
Oh.
She'll appear on the site again in another video.
Good move.
In a couple of weeks. I know. I hear she's kind of popular on the interwebs.
I heard that too. And of course, Veronica, my friend, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad I got to come to the cottage. I'm sad Leah wasn't here, but it was fun hanging out with you guys too.
We will be having a new Sword and Laser within the next couple of months. We're reading a Game of Thrones right now, if you're into that sort of thing, swordandlaser.com. But of course, they can watch you on Techzilla.
Yep, Techzilla.com and Quora on the PlayStation Network.
And veronicabelmont.com to keep up with you.
Correct.
All right. I'm Tom Merritt. I haven't done nearly enough plugging. CNET's going to be mad at me. Buzz Out Loud is the show that I do every day at CNET, bol.cnet.com. I do the Sword and Laser. I do East Meets West. I do a lot of other things. You can keep up with me at tommerritt.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, but it's really a pain in the ass sort of username. So just go to @TomMerritt, and then you can find my actual username there. Thanks again, Leo. Thanks again, Colleen and Dane. And thanks, everybody, for being on the show. Another Twit is in the can.
This is amazing.
Round the horn. Oh.